Okay, I'm glad to see everybody tonight. We have all of, 11 people. But we're excited and appreciate you being here and coming out to our study tonight. The story of the Tower of Babel is the beginning of the history, really, for modern man. I know that whenever we talk about the beginning of man, we think of Genesis, and of course it was. But in reality, there was a reset given when we talk about the flood and the Tower of Babel, Genesis chapter 9. And in verse 1, the beginning of the world that we live in, because the world before the flood was just very different than after the flood, the world that you and I live in. In Genesis chapter 9, you remember in verse 2 that God tells Noah, now the flood's already happened, everybody's died except the eight, and he comes to Noah and he says, "The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, on every bird of the air, and on all that move on the earth, and all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herb. But you shall not eat flesh with the life that is the blood. Surely for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast I will require it, and from the hand of man. From the hand of every man's brother I will require the life of a man, that whosoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply. And God spoke to Noah and said to his sons and to him, and as for me, behold, I will establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you." So, what's kind of interesting about this is that from the creation to the flood, man was a vegetarian. He didn't eat meat. And the fear of animals was not on man. It was kind of like, lack of a better expression, the Dr. Doolittle world, that man and animals kind of interacted with one another. And so it was a very unique kind of a world that now has changed, and God says that I'm going to give these animals for food for you, and that you now can, of course, eat meat, but not the blood, and the lifeblood is in there. But what is also especially kind of interesting about this is to imagine when you're reading about Adam and Cain and Abel and Methuselah and whomever, that they all spoke one language. Imagine living in the world if there were 6 billion people. I don't know how many people were in the world at the time of the flood, but there were probably a lot of people. But imagine living in this world and everybody spoke the same language. Doesn't matter where you go, everybody, and that's the way the world was. They all had the same language. But then in Genesis chapter 10, Moses begins to describe the division of the world and how the world was populated. Now, Genesis 10 is the nations that descended from Noah, his three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. And what happens is that, you generally know where about the mountain of Ararat. Of course, I've got PowerPoint. I could have put it up there, but you're good students. You know where it's at. The descendants of Japheth sort of went to the European side of things. They went in the European side. If you look in Genesis 10 and verse 5, "From these the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, and through the nations." And so Jephthah's descendants, they all kind of migrated northwest. And then the descendants of Ham populated the Middle East and the African continent. In verse 6, the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. And these are Egyptian names. These are names that have to do with the African continent. And also in verse 11, in the land he went to Assyria and built Nineveh. And that's kind of up in that area. So the Middle East and generally in that area into the African continent, that's where the descendants of Ham went. Now, one side note is that we are familiar with the city of Nineveh and realize that among the cities of the world, the city of Nineveh and whose remains we still find today, you can go to Nineveh. It's probably not a safe place to be, but it's still there. And you'll still find the ruins. And it's been here since this time period. But that's kind of where the descendants of Ham went. And then Shem, in verse 30, says that their dwelling place was from Mesh as you go toward Sephar, the mountains of the east. And so what happened to the descendants of Shem, they went to the east. And that's where China came from, and that's where India and all of those descendants over there. So that's the way the world was created or populated. Now, you realize that when you're reading this, for example, that it speaks about their nations and their language. Well, Moses is writing the story, and so he tells about the flood and tells about how the world was populated. And he's going to kind of come back in the 11th chapter and talk about how that actually happened. For example, in chapter 10 and verse 25, one of the interesting passages in there is one of the sons of Ham. His name was Eber. And Moses says in chapter 10 and verse 25 that to Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. It's kind of a neat thought. You kind of wonder, okay, there's eight people in the world, in the land and the mountain of Ararat. How did everybody get everywhere? Well, you can imagine, and it took a lot of time, that, you know, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, that's what chapter 10 is all about, they started having children, who started having children, who started having children, and everybody started leaving town. And we'll see why that happens in a minute. But that they went everywhere, and they, you know, maybe in the North American continent, they came over the Aleutian, bypass up there in Alaska and kind of came down and settled, and the world became populated, and it happened in the days of Peleg that the earth was divided. And in all of these divisions, it says, like in Jephthah, in verse 5, that the people were divided according to their language. In verse 20, it says that these were the sons of Ham according to their families, according to their languages. In verse 31, these were the sons of Shem according to their families, according to their languages. But see, it hadn't happened yet. He's just describing that the division of the world, that Ham, Shem, and Japheth, their people divided because of languages. The very last verse in chapter 10 says that these were the families of the sons of Noah according to their generations, in their nations, and from these nations, the nations were divided on earth after the flood. And so that's how the world became populated. But how did that actually come about? What happened is after the flood, they just didn't all say, okay, let's all leave. As a matter of fact, they did the opposite. After the flood and they began to populate, they kind of stayed home. I'm thinking Noah's wondering, are you ever going to leave home? You know, go somewhere. But they all kind of stayed around in that area, and that's where chapter 11 is introduced. And Moses is kind of going back and telling the story, and we'll see why this has to be told, particularly in Shem's descendants, in a moment. So let's read the story real quick in chapter 11 and verse 1, because now Moses is going to go back and explain how that at one time that the whole world was in one language, but now they're all divided by, you know, where did that come from? How did that happen? Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. Again, very fascinating. The Hebrew word is that they had one lip, is how they spoke. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they began to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down, and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore, its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. Well, the point of reference here really is about Tyre. If you look at the end of the chapter there, this is leading up to introduce us to Abraham. But we have to find out why this all happened. The Tower of Babel is a familiar Bible story. Even those who don't recognize the Bible recognize the story of the Tower of Babel. But there are some interesting things that we learn about the Tower of Babel, I think, that are important to know. And that is that at this time, the flood did not accomplish, and God didn't intend it to, it did not accomplish the destruction of sin. And that men did not change. Why did the flood come? Well, the flood came because God saw the wickedness of man was great, and it grieved his heart that he made man. So what did he decide to do? He comes to Noah and he says, listen, I'm going to kill everybody on the face of this earth except you and your family. What you need to do, build an ark, and that's what he did, and we know how that happened. But while God's plan was to destroy evil men, and while the flood destroyed every living being on the face of this earth, it did not destroy evil. As a matter of fact, if you look back in Genesis chapter 9, after the flood, they've come out of the flood, and again, there's sort of a time period here, so it's not kind of an immediacy. God made a promise that while the earth remained, there would continue to be seed time and harvest and cold and heat and winter, summer, day and night. But in chapter 9 and in verse 18, the sons of Noah, who went out of the ark, were Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Ham was the father of Canaan. Now these three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole world was populated. Verse 20. And Noah began to be a farmer. This is in Genesis chapter 9, verse 20. And Noah began to be a farmer, and he planted a vineyard. Then he drank of the wine, and was drunk, and became uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father. And their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. So Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done to him. And he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants, he shall be to his brethren. And he said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. So what happened is that after the flood, Noah was a farmer, and again, time to plant the grapes, and time for the grapes, you know, this may have taken a few years to grow, I don't know, to produce. But then when the grapes finally arrived there, then what he did was that he made him some wine, and he got drunk. So, I mean, the flood didn't take away sin. It didn't take away the desire to do that. And then what Ham did, and there's a lot of speculation about what this meant, but it seems to be a connect with, of course, what happened with Noah. He uncovered himself. And it seems to be that Ham did something to him or did something that when Noah woke up, he knew what had gone on. But whatever it was a sinful thing, and Noah cursed his son Ham, is cursed to be Canaan, the servant of servants. So when you look at the flood, you think, well, that solved everything. No, it didn't. I mean, the flood cannot, you know, it did take away everybody that lived, but it was not something that was going to solve all the problems. The Tower of Babel was really just an extension of the problem of sin. Because when you come to the Tower of Babel, what's happening? Well, when you come to the Tower of Babel, they're all together. Nothing wrong with that. They want to build a city. Nothing wrong with that. They want to build a tower. Nothing wrong with that. I think kind of as a side note, it may be noted that even in this early time period, again, this goes back even to Genesis chapter 4, when Cain built a city and Enoch built a city. You see in chapter 11 and in verse 3 that they knew how to use bricks and they knew how to bake them and they had asphalt for mortar. So man didn't grow up in a cave somewhere, as people like to think about, well, they grew up there in the caves. They knew how to build cities. They were able to build towers. Now, these towers are something that are massive things. They're not like skyscrapers. In your notes, there's kind of a, they're called ziggurats, but they create these huge base, and they begin to build. And so the sin of the people was that what they wanted to do was that they wanted to exalt themselves as gods. And the sin that they were committing here was not about building a city, and it wasn't a sin to build the tower. But the reason that they were doing it was because they wanted to reach into heaven. Whether they were speculating they were going to try to reach where God was, or they were just going to do what we do, want to see how big we can build the biggest thing we've got. But they wanted to make a name for themselves. They were filled with pride. And they wanted to build a tower that would magnify their wisdom and say, look how great we are. That's sinful attitude. And again, the intent was found that let's make a name for ourselves. And so really the Tower of Babel represented the sin of humanity. And they wanted to go and do this. And what's kind of interesting, ironic, did you notice why they wanted to do it in verse 4? They didn't want to be scattered all over the earth. So how'd that work out for you? Because they wanted to stay there and make a great name for themselves. And so God came down and he intervened. Now, again, it could be argued that if God did not intervene, there'd be another reason for a flood. Because the world originally spoke in one language and one speech, and all men became so evil that God destroyed them. And somebody has suggested that, you know, the problem with the flood was it didn't wipe away sin, and the problem with the tower was that if God allowed them to remain as they are, united as one under one speech and one language, all of a sudden now you've got a whole world that is so corrupt it's going to be again, you know, a problem. You know, food for thought. But God had told Noah in Genesis 9, I'll never do this again with water. God made a promise, and I can assure you, beyond all of the climate change pundits that are in the world is not going to sink into the ocean. God's not going to allow that. Now, it is reserved for fire, but not for water. But you see, the wisdom of men tried to answer the problem of sin, and there's nothing that man can do about that. And what they were really trying to do was they were trying to make gods of themselves. Well, the problem with that is that even in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 3 and 4, under the law of Moses, that God reminds the people that, listen, the blood of bulls and goats couldn't take away sin. So what the Tower of Babel represented was that men were trying to find an answer to their situation, and it just wasn't going to happen. It just was not going to solve their problem. And while they tried to make a name for themselves, this was not going to change their situation. And without the intervention of God, without God doing something, man would still be a creature who is seeking his own destruction. That's what happened before the flood. Because man filled himself with his own wisdom and he destroyed really himself. It's often said that, boy, the world is really getting worse, isn't it? No. It's been messed up since the beginning of time. It's always had problems. I mean, you think about how bad things are. And yes, there are times in our history that are better than others. I think we all could say safely that, you know, after 9/11, boy, everybody got religious, right? 9/11, churches were full. 9/11, we actually talked about God. At 9/11, people began to really come together as families. That didn't last very long. I mean, look at our country now. I mean, how long ago was 9/11? And here we are now, and we're living in a nation that is so divided and so filled with a lot of terrible things. And yet, man has not changed. And the great lesson to me about the Tower of Babel is that men won't change. When men try to change themselves because of themselves, they will not change. And Paul explained this in Romans chapter 1 and verse 18. Because the reason that God brought the flood upon the world is because of his wrath. And his wrath was against their wickedness. And the reason that he brought their wrath is what Paul explained in verse 18, Romans 1. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteous men. Why? Who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. That's what they were doing at the tower. They weren't just building a tower. They weren't just building a city. They were suppressing the truth. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. Verse 20. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their hearts, and their foolish hearts, They were futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. Here it is. And they changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, of birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. Well, that's what the people were doing at the tower. They were worshiping themselves. Let's build the tower, worship ourselves. And they were trying to find their own salvation with themselves. See, man didn't change. The flood didn't stop that. The flood just took out their neighbors and everybody else. But it did not change the problem of sin. And this continued to go on. And this is the problem with men, is that they're still trying to find answers. And that's why immorality is so rampant, is because, again, verse 24, you look in Romans 1, you see all the things that are there. It's like reading the newspaper. Therefore, God gave them up to uncleanness and the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie. They worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. For this reason, God gave them up to vile passions. Even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise, the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another, men with men, committing what is shameful, receiving in themselves the penalty of their error, which is due. They didn't like to retain God in the knowledge. And Paul goes on and talks about, look what that does. That's all the tower was doing. The Tower of Babel is about men trying to figure out what to do with sin, and they can't do it because they were still rebelling against God. The second lesson I think we learn here, and I read this actually in Bob Waldron's book that he had about the book of Genesis, and it's kind of an amazing statement. When you think about the division of the world or the use of languages, what was that really all about? Why did God do that? Was he just saying, hey, this will be fun, let's make all the different languages? There was, I think, a greater purpose that's still being accomplished today. There's a lot of fear in the world of somebody dominating the world. Again, you know, pinky in the brain. Poor mouse wants to rule the world. And we've watched movies, we've watched series, we read books about world domination. I mean, some of the great, you know, movies are about these aliens that come and they're going to dominate the universe and the force be with you and all the empire and all that kind of good stuff. Ain't going to happen. I knew growing up, you know who the USSR is, you know. We were scared to death of the Russians because they were going to take over the world. We were afraid China is trying to take... This whole concept that people have that, well, somebody's going to take over the world. The Tower of Babel proves that it will never happen. Napoleon tried to take over the world. But what did he have? His Waterloo. Do you know who gave him his Waterloo? God did. That wasn't a fluke. Everybody, every nation has their Waterloo. You ask Hitler, who was going to have the thousand-year reign of the Third Reich, guess what happened to it? It's not here. The empire of the rising sun, how did that work out? Yeah, it didn't happen. It's not going to happen. And for that matter, America is not going to be a great superpower forever. The whole idea of any nation ever having world dominance, the closest that ever actually happened, not really even actually, was the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire had Europe, they had Britain, they had North Africa, they had the Middle East, and into India. But other than that, they didn't have the world. And one of the things that is accomplished by the Tower of Babel is in Genesis chapter 11 and in verse 9. Because when God came down to see what they were doing, and he said, if we don't do something, you know, there's nothing that's going to stop them. But what the Lord did is he scattered everybody abroad over the face of all the earth. And by doing that, he diffused the power of man to be united as one. There will never, biblically speaking, according to the authority of God, there will never be an occasion when any nation rules the world, any language rules the world, and there will never be any religion. I know that when Islam first came out and people were really all scared about that, Islam, I had brethren who were telling me, oh, Islam's going to take over the world. No, it's not. That's an impossibility. The Lord will not allow it to happen. I mean, the United Nations is kind of an interesting scientific experiment. But how does the United Nations is a good demonstration of how this doesn't work out. And the other thing to remember is what Paul said in the book of Acts. This is one of the great, not that the other ones are not great, but this is one of the great revelations, I think, that we have to always stick in our back pocket and hang on to it. In Acts chapter 17, in verse 26, Paul says something that is astounding, really, because he defines so many things that are going on in our world. He is in the city of Athens. He's there on Mars Hill, and he's preaching to these people that are filled their lives with idolatry and everything. And he tells them about the unknown God, the true and the living God. And he says in verse 26 that this living God has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell upon all the face of the earth. And he has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings. That is so cool. Because here's what that means. We talked about this last week. God raises nations and he brings them down. When God is satisfied that a nation has exercised their usefulness and he wants to bring them down, he does. But when he says that he has determined a habitation, what he does is he draws a line and he says, you will go no further. It's kind of like the waves of the sea. There's a habitation that they dwell in. They will remain where they are. I know there's the ebb and flow of the tide. That's not what we're talking about. The oceans will remain in place. The stars are established and the moon and the sun. They're there. They're in a fixed habitation. They're not going to change. The sun's not going to move. The moon's not going to rotate. It's set in its habitation. And the character of man is we are established in our habitation because God's the one that established that. And so what he does is that he says that all nations are going to be where they are. God will never allow one group of people to have any kind of world dominance. Even during the Second World War between the Germans and the Japanese, they took a lot of territory, but they didn't keep it very long. Why? Because God said, you can't do that. Okay, now I got to interject one more thing. And guess what? I know, bad news for you Star Wars fans. We will never live on another planet. I mean, we can go investigate and we can go and see, but this whole idea that man is going to go live on some planet some far off is fallacy. Because Paul said we have a habitation. Number one, we can't do it physically because our bodies can only take certain amount of G's. We can only live for a certain amount of times and we're not made to live on the moon. We're not made to live on Mars. It's amazing that we send instruments up there to look at it. I think it's the neatest thing in the world. But all we're saying is no man or nation is going to rule the world. And there's no fear that that's ever going to happen. And why? Because God came down to the Tower of Babel and said, poof. And that had to be a funny moment. I mean, really? You know, you're talking to your wife and all of a sudden you can't understand her. He didn't do that in families, right? He wouldn't have done that, you know. But I mean, here's groups of people and they're all speaking the same language. Pass me a hammer, you know, pass me something. And all of a sudden, they're speaking some different language. And they began to, apparently by the sons, they began to migrate themselves. And what happens is the world becomes divided. And everybody goes to their place. And languages develop. And cultures develop. And nations are established. And that's God diffusing what man can do. But yet on the other hand, unity is when men speak the same language. You know, when they came together and they wanted to build this tower, they had a good reason to do so because they were so united. They were so together. That God said in verse 6, the people are one. Why? Because they spoke the same language. And he said, secondly, they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now, nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. God recognized an attribute that has a positive message for the world. In the negative, there's a positive. Because that's the truth. If you have unity is found in speaking the same language. And the reason that God confounded the language was why? To destroy their unity. That's how. Because when you get, you know, it's kind of like, one bee doesn't bother you. 400 of them will get you worried. One mosquito, but if you walk out with 800, I mean, there's unity. One snowflake's not a big deal. 3 million of them, that's a bigger deal. I mean, the reason God confounded the language was to destroy their unity. But the opposite of that shows what man can do when they are united. I think that Genesis 11 and verse 6, that ought to be the motto for the church. That ought to be what we're all about. But because God said, when people are united under the same language, there is nothing that they cannot accomplish. Go over to the New Testament in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. You remember that in the early church, the problem in Corinth was the opposite of that. Because they were divided, they were mad at one another, they were allowing immorality to go on, there was confusion and chaos. And the reason was because in chapter 1 and verse 10, Paul, as he was told by the house of Chloe, that I plead with you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all speak the same thing, that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment. Now, what had happened was that they were divided and they weren't getting anything done. Paul says, here's unity. You need to speak the same thing. You don't need to be one Apollos, one Paul, one Cephas, one Christ. You need to have no divisions. You need to be perfectly joined together. You need to have the same mind and the same judgment. That's what was going on at the Tower of Babel. Now, they were doing it for the wrong reason. But that's why there's so much religious error today. Do you know why there are so many churches that are different today? Because we don't speak the same thing. Because there is division. We are not perfectly joined together. We are not of the same mind and we're not of the same judgment. But when two people come together and they understand the Word of God together, what happens? They're unified. And when somebody comes together and they agree with what God's Word says, they're unified. And so the lesson of Genesis 11:6, that albeit it was used for the wrong purpose, is the kind of purpose that we should have, because if we speak the same language, then we're going to be united. We have the same purpose and the same cause. And as the Lord said, if we are united, there is nothing we cannot do. We can turn the world upside down. But sometimes that's just not the case. The Tower of Babel is preserved in history to show where the nations came from. The Tower of Babel is about pride. The Tower of Babel is about the fact that sin's always there. Even when Jesus came, He didn't take away sin. He gave us an answer for sin. The flood did not remove sin. It removed the blight that was on the earth, but it was only through Jesus Christ. But the problem with sin is always going to be a problem with humanity. And we recognize that. And the other thing is, and this is, I think, one of the great lessons about the Tower of Babel, God's will always overrides the will of man. And there's a sense in which we look at God looking... We see God looking down upon this tower, and they build it for a little while, and then God says, okay, that's going to come to an end. He still does that. When He sees the purpose of man is something that He's not willing to accept, He stops it. And I tell you, there are times in history that I think I can confidently say, that's when God said no, that's when God said no, that's when God said no. Because God's will always overrides the will of man, even if he wants to build a tower to heaven. And then finally, that there is value in unity found when men speak. Now, we said the flood did not solve the problem of sin, and nothing can take sin away but the sacrifice of Jesus. There was something kind of neat that I discovered. It, not a big deal, but there is a vivid reminder of the story of Babel. There is a vivid reminder of the story of Babel at the cross of Jesus Christ. Do you know what that is? It's like God said, wait a minute, let me remind you of something that happened a long time ago. And it represented what man's attempt of trying to save himself. It represented what happens when men try to exalt themselves against God. Do you remember what happened at the cross of Jesus Christ that goes all the way back to the Tower of Babel? It's in the Gospel of John, the 19th chapter, in verse 19. John 19, Jesus has been crucified. He has already borne his cross. They've come to Golgotha. They have crucified him. And it says in verse 19 of John 19 that Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross. And the writing was, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Then many of the Jews read this title, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. The representation of the division of the world by three different languages. It was written so everybody could read it, of course, for the Hebrews, those who read Hebrew, those in the Greek, and of course the Latin of the Romans. And it's almost as if an antitype and a shadow of God once again reminding us about that scene so long ago in the Tower of Babel that, you know, you want to build a tower to heaven? That's not going to save you, but I'm going to raise up my son. He will save you. And they were doing it for their own pride. God did it for our good, that we could be saved. And the fact that there's only unity in the reality that God is going to give us Jesus Christ. Their three languages are above the very one. Three languages are above the very one who made that happen. Because if you remember in our reading, when God is talking about going and doing something, what does he say? Let us go down there and confuse their language. And right above the head of Jesus, the Son of God, was his title in three different languages. Tower of Babel. Men have not changed. No man or nation will ever rule the world. And unity is when men speak the same language. But finally, the only answer really that we have about sin is in Jesus Christ. And there will come a day when the world will be destroyed by the flood, by the fire, not the flood. And the only salvation we're going to have is when we trust in the one who is on the cross. I hope this helps in some ways. Think about these things as together we stand, as we sing. I have decided to